From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, 9 dead in a church massacre in Charleston, and the country reels. The Pope weighs in on climate change. Jeb Bush makes his candidacy official. Shocking slaughter in Charleston, a collision of hate and prayer. Here is Malcolm Graham, the brother of Cynthia Hurd, one of the victims.
Anytime that you can't go in the house of God and worship in peace, there's a problem with the morality of our country.
From the Vatican, Pope Francis weighs in big on climate change with a call for urgent action.
Questa nostra casa.
This is our home, he said. If it is ruined, it damages everyone, especially the poor.
And former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, son and brother of presidents, announces he's running for president. No special privileges, he says.
It's nobody's turn. It's everybody's test. And it's wide open, exactly as a contest for president should be.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with April Ryan of the American Urban Radio Networks, John McCormick of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on Charleston, on the Pope and climate, on Jeb Bush? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us today from Baltimore, April Ryan, White House correspondent, Washington Bureau Chief for the American Urban Radio Networks, author of The Presidency in Black and White. April Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. Joining us from Washington is John McCormick, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. John, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, April, and John.
Just as bad as it could be out of Charleston this week. Here's Margaret Mitchell Rivers, a resident in Charleston, talking with the AP about the emotions that have swept over her and so many others in the wake of the terrible shooting at the AME church there Wednesday night.
I have really not slept since I heard. It has just been heartache all day long, just praying, breath praying, and praying out loud.
Just praying, praying, praying out loud. April Ryan, we've got the alleged shooter in custody, Dylan Roof, 21 years old, 9 counts of murder. What have you made of this, April?
Well, do we call him alleged now since he's confessed? That's one thing. Who is it? What kind of person? And I'm an African-American, and I'm also someone who lived down south for a little bit during the summers with my grandparents.
Yes.
And it's for a kid, from the big city, I guess, going back down south during the summer, it's no big deal because that's something that always happens. And it always happens when you're in the south. You're in church during the week for missionary meetings or for choir rehearsal or for prayer meetings or for Bible study. And when I heard that happen, I said, oh, my gosh, it touched so many people, not just the African-American community, but humanity as a whole. And who does this, sits there and watches a group of people talk about hope, love, God, a better day, a brighter day,
yeah,
and turns around and takes out a gun and starts shooting and saying why he's doing this and for the reasons, the hate, the racial hate. Take back our country, things of that nature. It just, it's unfathomable. And it makes you think back to the 16th Street Church back in the 1960s.
Birmingham.
In Alabama. Yeah, Birmingham, Alabama. It's painful. It's painful as a person. It's painful as an African-American. As a journalist, I'm waiting to hear what the president has to say. And he's spoken and we're waiting to see more.
John McCormick, I mean, since I was a boy, I've been welcomed again and again into black churches. Here came this young man, Dylan Roof. He sat with this group, Bible study prayer group, for nearly an hour before the shooting began. You can imagine people looking a little sideways, but okay, here's a guy, maybe looks even a little troubled. I've seen that kind of courtesy and openness again and again in black churches. These people paid with their lives. What are you making of this story as we talk today, John?
Well, it's hard to make any sense of it. I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking and utterly horrific. I mean, especially no matter who these people were, but when you read the stories of the lives they lived, they were dedicated to their community. They had dedicated their lives to Christ. A librarian, a coach, a young nephew who tried to shield his elderly aunt from being shot before he was gunned down, and so was she. Each story just breaks your heart. I don't think there's really much you can make of it, other than that, you know, some people are jumping to the conclusion asking, was this guy mentally ill? I don't think we have any evidence of that so far. It could just be that he was an evil white supremacist racist. He was flying these racist flags of apartheid South Africa, had them on his jacket. He had spoken to his roommate. One of the most senseless things of this is that his roommate had been told that he intended to start a race war, and his roommate didn't say anything. He knew that he had a gun, and he didn't say anything. He didn't report it to the police. It's absolutely horrific. I don't know what to make of it.
We've got this from Joseph Meeks Jr. This was a friend of the alleged shooter, now charged, Dylan Roof. Has talked with NBC News about comments, anti-African-American comments Roof had made.
He was just saying how he didn't agree with the Trayvon Martin case, how he wanted segregation, he wanted it to be white with white and black with black, and that he didn't believe in what the black race was doing to the white race.
John McCormick, the take our country back language that he allegedly used before the shooting began in the church, there are echoes of that. There are versions of that in political speech in this country, not in hate quarters. Is that a mistake?
That specific phrase has been used by both sides. I think that it would go a little bit far to blame either anyone, Republican or Democrat. I believe that there was a Take Back Our Country conference held by Democrats during the Bush years. So really, I wouldn't say that in particular. But obviously, I mean, whether this guy was mentally or not, that a climate of racism, I think that anyone who has espoused racism has blood on their hands. Yes, people, whether he was just an evil person who was tapped in this evil movement or someone who is off and got sucked into it, I don't know. But yeah, anyone who is promoting the idea of a race war or that we should have segregation, I think that they bear some culpability for this. They bear some guilt in some way.
Jack Beatty, we know we haven't made it to the promised land here on race in this country, but there has been so much progress in the last 40, 50 years. And then this happens and you turn around and wonder, how do we actually finally escape this? As minority presence grows and their power grows in this country, and of course it will with numbers and with a reduction in discrimination and prejudice, there seems to be this irreducible fringe of hate. And here, 9 lives. That's not a fringe number.
No, and this from a young man, you know, from someone who grew up in this climate, not an old timer like me, steeped in something else. You know, James Baldwin, the great African-American essayist and novelist, wrote, "People are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them." And really, that is it, is part of the story here. The American historical unconscious is there. The images of racism are there. The centuries of white over black, it's there. And that's a great threat to America today and the future. The unfinished business, not just of the civil rights movement, but of America, it remains, and we all know, deeply flawed and deeply unfinished. And the other side, of course, the president spoke to that. These massacres don't happen all over the world. They only seem to happen here. Now, why is that? Well, we don't have to be geniuses to figure that out, the ubiquity of guns. And so long as that, as the gun remains such a part of American life, with its rights and its politics and its spending and all the rest, you're going to put people, that racists together with guns and crazy people together with guns, and things like this are going to keep happening.
David in Franklin, Massachusetts is calling. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I had a couple of thoughts on this. The one thing on this shootings, the one thing that really strikes me is how embedded racism is in our culture and how systemic it is. And in particular, even with the media references of things and questioning the sanity of the shooter. If you look at the coverage of the media when a black shoots a black as part of a gang war, you don't question the sanity of those guys. They're just part of a gang. It's not they're insane or, you know, what's wrong with them. But this guy, I think, pictured himself, whether or not he was, as a member of a gang, of the white gang. And, you know, that's what this is about, is the superiority of the white race to the black race and how things are changing. And he didn't like the way things are changing. And, you know, that, and the other aspect of it, I think, is people, other people, and particularly in Republican quarters, and I do think you can make this a Republican-Democrat issue. Republican quarters, they want to emphasize the fact that this was a shooting in a Christian church. Well, it's an attack on religion. Well, this was not an attack on religion. This was an attack on black people by a white man. I lived for 40 years in the South. I've been in Massachusetts for the last 6 years, and I can tell you I'm sort of a political refugee from the South. And I can tell you how many times I've heard racial jokes over the years, how frustrated and angry I was, how much of a tiny minority that I felt. And I can tell you that there are a significant percentage, larger than you would think, of white people down there right now who are not saddened and enraged by these shootings.
In fairness, David, I've seen an awful lot of white people come out in Charleston, join with African Americans there in church and beyond to mourn and grieve over what's happened. I take your point. On the other hand, when you look at this young man, doesn't he look troubled to you, David?
Yes, he was troubled. But my point is that emphasizing his troubledness is beside the point. The point is that he was part of a systemic culture that brought him in. And yes, he's on the fringe of that culture, but he's a part of a systemic racism that is throughout this country, but is particularly in the South.
David, we've got it. April Ryan, what do we do with, I don't know if it's right to call them last vestiges, but whatever remains, large or small, of fiery racism in this country against all the progress that's been made? How do we address that?
Tom, that's a very good point. How we address it, first of all, you have to look at it as a heart issue. And the reason why I say that, I covered Bill Clinton, when I started going to the White House 18 years ago. And he looked at it as a heart issue. And you start with the heart and then go to legislation. But there's a lot more that we can talk about after
the
break.
We will, right after a break. April Ryan, please stand by in Baltimore. John McCormick with the Weekly Standard in Washington. April's with the American Urban Radio Networks. Jack Beatty is with us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. 9 dead in Charleston. The Pope and climate change, Jeb Bush formally declares. April Ryan is with us from Baltimore today, White House correspondent, bureau chief in Washington for American Urban Radio Networks, author of The Presidency in Black and White. John McCormick is with us, senior writer at the Weekly Standard. Jack Beatty is here. The president spoke at a press conference yesterday expressing grief at the shootings in Charleston, pointing out that this was not the first time he's had to make a speech after a tragic shooting. There have been many in his years in office.
I've had to make statements like this too many times. Communities like this have had to endure tragedies like this too many times. We don't have all the facts, but we do know that, once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun.
No trouble getting their hands on a gun, and there's the gun piece right in the middle of it. There are oceans of guns in this country. April, I want to bring to you, we were looking at where do we go, how do we get past this, mm-hmm. what can sometimes seem like a last irreducible margin of racism. And along with that, we've got one of our listeners online asking here, why is Dylann Roof not being called a terrorist? I don't know if that's an important issue to you or not, or a semantic issue.
Yes, it is. It's important, and it's semantics for some in Washington. But when you look at the definition of terror, the federal definition of terror, it talks about intimidation and fear, and there definitely was intimidation and fear. And in my eyes, in my reporting, he is considered a terrorist, a domestic terrorist, not the terrorist that you would consider ISIL or Al-Qaeda, but a domestic terrorist, mm-hmm. Someone like Timothy McVeigh, someone like the people who committed the 16th Street bombings in Alabama, along that line. Mm-hmm. And some of the situations that we've seen here, Gabrielle Giffords, things of that nature. But getting back to the issue of racism, Bill Clinton started this in his second term, the conversation on race, understanding that we were a nation that was browning. It's not a concept. It's not an idea. It is something that's actually happening mm-hmm. now. It's mm-hmm. a fact now. The majority of babies born in this country are a minority. And he said we had to have a coming together because the older Americans still kind of maybe felt that vestige, but the younger people, he thought that he could pull and tug at their hearts. But what I don't understand is you have this young man, Dylann Roof, who it had to have been around 19 or so when he was 19 years ago, apartheid in South Africa was ended. How did he know about about apartheid the way he does. And that's something that you have to figure out for these young people.
Well, you know, there's such an active online white supremacist movement out there. It is not hard to tap into that, if you're focused on doing
it. But he's 21. And I mean, he's 21 and apartheid ended around 19 years ago or so. So it was either taught or he looked at it, but it was in his heart. It was put in his heart, placed in his heart. How or did he pull it into himself? We don't know. We're still trying to find this out. But once again, it's a heart issue. You can legislate, but so much. But it's a heart issue at this point.
May I ask you about something? Here's one of our listeners writes, please highlight the remarkable love, compassion, forgiveness on display in Charleston. And I must say, Mayor Joseph Riley has seemed to be quite good there. We do remember, of course, in North Charleston just weeks ago when there was such a quick and effective reaction to the shooting by the police officer there. And yet here again, there seems to be pretty effective and quick. And, of course, Dylan Roof was arrested quite quickly. Our listener says, please contrast this with the reaction in Baltimore. You're in Baltimore. What do you make of that, April?
I'm from Baltimore. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Baltimore, and I live on the in the suburbs of Baltimore now. I'm really pleased with what I see in Charleston. I mean, quick reaction. They're calling it out here in Baltimore. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the culture. I know that the police officers here are very concerned. And not only do you have a situation with Freddie Gray that, you know, there was a white officer, there were six officers, different colors, mm-hmm. black and white, that were all culpable. So you have the police department who is trying to say, look, we're not all bad. But yes, there are some bad apples, but they're also at the same time, they're struggling themselves with this. And they're trying to deal with this. But we had a situation that stemmed back several mayors ago, zero tolerance. Mm-hmm. And the man who's running for president, Martin O'Malley, was that person who put that in place. And when you talk about zero tolerance, it's like if you do something, we're gonna crack down and crack down hard. Mm-hmm. And the vestiges of that kept going and going. So it's a mishmash. It's a pot of a lot of old residue, as well as new things that are coming in Baltimore. And it needs to be fixed. It has to be fixed. And I am a resident of this community. And it's very sad. It's very sad to see this.
John McCormick, Jack, I want to come to you on this, if I may. First, Augusta, Georgia. Wes is calling. Wes, you're on the air. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Basically, my concern is the fact that what this situation does is it fails to answer the extension of race privilege in America and the fact that we, as white people, have not acknowledged the fact that it exists. And even the conversation that's been engaged in this, mm-hmm. this concept of progress, as you said, it fails to fully acknowledge the fact of that there are a lot of unarmed black people that have been killed by white police officers in recent weeks and months, mm-hmm. and the fact that in
years,
just this year this has happened. And so it's extremely unfortunate in the fact that that's not being addressed, and the fact that we want to talk about this man looking troubled. Anybody that gets arrested looks troubled. You know, the true fact.
Yeah, but I mean, long before he was arrested, look at those photographs of him with the jacket and the racist patches on there. I mean, and the stories that we've now learned about him being barred from a shopping mall, you know, kind of odd at school. I mean, I don't want to make excuses at all.
It's a hate crime.
Yes, sir.
That's what we're saying. That's the conversation that needs to be engaged in. And the fact that we need to address the fact that white privilege is a thing and it still happens in America. And anytime that we talk about this man being troubled or that we say, hey, this is not, you know, it's not as grand as the problem truly is, we're diminishing the fact. And we need to address the problem of white privilege before we can move forward and achieve the progress that you're discussing, I think.
Wes, I'll take it just as you deliver it there, and I accept that we have still a grand problem here. No dispute about that. I'm trying to be real about the whole. Jack Beatty, how do we talk about the progress that has, we like to think, been made and simultaneously fully acknowledge, and we have seen this, as our caller Wes says, in recent months and as April says, for years, the drumbeat of evidence of deeply unresolved issues around race in this country, privilege and more.
Yes, and we also have to deal with the frightening prospect that this recrudescence of hatred that we see and violence against African Americans is caused by the progress. That seemed to be what this young man was saying. You folks are getting uppity. You're going way ahead. You're raping our women. You're running wild.
Well, there's an old one.
Yeah, and that is a really frightening thought, that as the country becomes more diverse, it becomes less tolerant. Now, there have been some political science studies of attitudes that show that, that when people are told, for example, just how diverse the country is, they give you one answer. But when they're told how diverse it's becoming, they are much less tolerant about it. That is to say, white Americans. So we're in a frightening situation where there's a dialectic between the progress and the regress, between the movement ahead and this horrible, horrifying movement back.
John McCormick, what do we do about this? What do we do about it when we think about individuals, even young individuals like Dylann Roof, with very racist attitudes, whatever the packaging around them? What do we do more widely when we've got plenty of people who still see privilege, who still see prejudice, who see structural impediments to many African Americans and others advancing? What do we do here, John?
Well, I think it's completely fair to have an open debate about anything that can be done to prevent these things from happening in the future, whether that's gun policy or stuff with mental illness or right to bear arms. I think those are all fair questions. What I don't like is, I thought from one of your first callers, sort of this attempt to sort of smear people, score cheap political points off of this. And I think we should have an open and fair debate here. The question I would ask for those like the president who are bringing up the issue of gun control right now is,
you call it a smear, but if I may, I think it was an earnest observation. You may not like it, but does that make it a smear? That was
no.
Just...
I would say to suggest that somehow Republicans in general or have some blame for this. It was the first caller. It was a while ago. Mm-hmm. But I just think this general idea. It's completely fair. If there's a gun control policy out there that someone thinks that can stop these things from happening in the future, they should propose that. But the point I would make right here is, I don't know of a specific proposal that the president or any Democrat has endorsed that would have stopped this. This was not an assault weapon. This was not a high capacity magazine, from what I've seen. This was a standard pistol. So are we talking about banning all handguns? There are other questions we can ask. Should we make it independent of this? Whether or not this specific individual was mentally ill, should we make it easier to involuntarily commit people? Right here, it seems like we had a breakdown of community, that the guy's own roommate knew that he was deranged and wanted to kill African Americans simply because they were black and he believed in white supremacy. That's just a huge moral failing on the part of his roommate. I don't know what policy can change that. I don't think we want to live in a society where we have armed guards at every church meeting or every school, but I mean, that's something.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of armed guards, and you won't know it. In a lot of black churches, there have been for years security who are dressed like any other churchgoer, and they have guns for the sake of protecting the church and the monies that the congregation gives during the offering. So that is something that has been going on for a while.
John, what about the temptation to politicians to tap into this race fear? I mean, you say not fair to point that at Republicans, and yet there's a clear history of Southern strategy and more, where no small number of people have gone to that button to press it one way or another to bring out voters. That's not a mystery. How does that flow through our politics in the decades ahead as this browning of America goes on? And you may well have whites accustomed, as our listener says, to an element of privilege that they're fearful of surrendering.
I wouldn't deny that there is a small fringe of racists in this country who will always exist, and we'll have to think of ways to deal with them. But the good news is that the vast, overwhelming majority of this country is not racist, that we have had a lot of good progress. And if we can put things in perspective, as horrific as this crime was, crime in general, murder, gun murders have gone down since the 1970s in terms of even – this isn't to diminish what's going on, but we just need to put things in perspective and think about real policies that can solve this rather than having some abstract debate that's not really going to fix anything.
Eric in Kansas City, Missouri. Eric, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for having me. Mm-hmm. I wanted to call and take a little bit of intellectual exception to the notion that, this occurs, this incident in particular occurred as a result of gun policy in the United States. I think that notion is created specifically to create some sort of cognitive dissonance in, the culture from, the issue of race. There's absolutely, unless your head is in the sand, that cognitive dissonance creates, talking point phrases like, we need to have an open debate about this, because...
Where are you going, Eric? I'm not following. You don't think it's about gun policy. What are you saying?
Well, I mean, statistically speaking, you know, they say that these things don't happen in other countries at the same rate. Well, police killings don't happen in other countries at the rate it happens in America either. But
all kinds of killings. We pin the needle. We're the world champ.
Exactly,
I mean,
right. The actual point that I'm making about this is the debate about whether or not there is a racial divide in this country is over. You ask what we should do about it. What we need to do about it is move toward acknowledgement of that existence and then work toward solving it. As long as we continue to have this debate and use gun control as a deflective talking point away from the issue, it's never going to be solved.
Eric, we got it. Go to race. Go to racism before guns, you say. I'll take it. Andy in Nashville. Andy, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
With the guns issue, I mean, I definitely feel a lot less safe. I'm a 41-year-old Caucasian transplant from Maryland to Tennessee. Spent my adult life in Tennessee. And anymore, yeah, absolutely, you can't go to Jimmy John's without looking at somebody's gun right in your face.
You mean they've got an open carry on their hip? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Everywhere you go. You know, it's very scary. Like, I don't even really like for someone to, you know, like, engage me. You know, because you don't want to get in an argument with someone.
But you heard our caller in Kansas City, Andy, saying, "Don't blame this on guns. This is about race, racism."
Right, and that's true. And my other point is that racism is absolutely alive and well. Since moving to the South, I mean, just spend some time in the South, and you will encounter it. It's quite disturbing. It's quite prevalent, and it's inescapable.
Andy, I appreciate your call. I'm not sure where to turn with this. It is so big. We're going to spend another full hour on it on Monday. April Ryan, last thoughts. We've got more to look at, but on Charleston at the end of this week, what is to be said?
At the end of this week, when it comes to the issue of gun control, the White House has tried. We don't know if they're going to try again with this after you've had issues like Columbine, Tucson, Aurora, Colorado, and Newtown. We just don't know where they're going to go. And then you had Charleston now. But I will say this. I think the spotlight has been put more so on the ills of the black community, the police-involved shootings, and racism more so because we do have a black president, because we have a black president, the spotlight is on equality, inequality more. And I think a lot of this is coming up and people are paying more attention to it because of, and it's not about his politic, it's the fact of the historic nature of this president of the United States. And we're looking at what's happening in the black community more so. So all of it seems like in the last couple of years, we're seeing more and more about the ills in the black community. And I do believe that it's related to the fact that we do have a black president.
Jack, as painful, as awful, sort of unforgivable as what we saw this week is, do you see us in a period where a more honest depth of insight about reality, privilege, and so on is being surfaced?
Well, I think events are surfacing it. I mean, certainly the whole issue of police behavior toward minorities, that has been a part of our lives for as long as I've been around. Now it's in the spotlight. Now the chance of change is at least possible. It wasn't in the past. And so I think that is, you know, if is that a measure of, you know, we're becoming more conscious of disadvantage? I think it is. What worries me is when you look at polls, it shows a real racial difference here. White people look on the police one way and African Americans another. White people think the police are great and not so great. And they're not as sympathetic as reality you'd think would make them to the problems the police create. Policing creates for minority youth.
John McCormick, we've got half a minute before the break. A final thought on Charleston this week, John.
I just think I hope that we can find a way to come together and find some real solutions here. I know that it's a heartbreaking moment, and I hope that after this we can sort of mourn and then start talking about what can actually be done to fix the situation.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Donald Trump announced he's running for president. The Daily Show's Jon Stewart could not hold back his joy at the comedic possibilities.
Thank you, Donald Trump, for making my last 6 weeks my best 6 weeks. No! He is putting me in some kind of comedy hospice.
Comedy heaven. Comedian Amber Ruffin on Late Night with Seth Meyers responded to Rachel Dolezal's claim that she identifies as black.
I am not a colored person. I'm black. Rachel Dolezal is a colored person. She is literally a person who colored herself. And that color is tangerine sable.
And Jurassic World grosses $500 million globally on its opening weekend, biggest box office in history.
She was designed to be bigger than the T-Rex.
What happened to the sibling?
She ate it.
We're looking at a week in the news. 9 dead in Charleston. The Pope and climate change. Jeb Bush formally declares for the presidency. April Ryan is with us from American Urban Radio Networks. John McCormick is here from the Weekly Standard. Jack Beatty's here. On Wednesday in Vatican City, Pope Francis spoke about his encyclical on the environment. Here interpreted by CNN.
This, our home, is being ruined and damaged. And it's affecting all of us, especially the poor. And so mine is an appeal to responsibility on the basis of the task that God has entrusted to men in creation to cultivate and to guard the garden where God has placed men.
Pope Francis weighing in big and deep, 180 pages, this encyclical from the Pope on climate change, urgent calls for action, calls this a moral issue. There's a lot in these many, many pages here. Lots of talk about economic systems, about wealth and poverty, about who's responsible to go first in fixing it. The rich, he says, and the poor, the most vulnerable. April Ryan, do you see the Pope's big entry into this arena as impactful? He explicitly wants it to be. Do you think it may change the chemistry, the conversation globally on climate change?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Anything the Pope says, people listen to, particularly this Pope. He's so progressive, and people are listening to him. He's different. He brings a fresh air of new ideas, and maybe for this country, some of the ideas are very liberal, to include this climate change issue. And I think Republicans need to really watch how they handle the Pope with this, attacking the Pope in any kind of way, because the Pope is someone many people listen to. I mean, from all religions, he's the Holy Father in Vatican City. But I think he does hit a point, though. The Pope does hit a point when he talks about the poor, how they are affected by climate change. Can we go back to the Bush years when we saw Hurricane Katrina? The Ninth Ward of New Orleans was impacted totally because of the levee break due to Hurricane Katrina, the severe storm. We're starting to see the storms rise and become worse. I mean, if you're a Republican, you believe it's God's hand, but if you people like Al Gore, you know, we have caused this. And maybe even now the Pope, and the Pope did say something that Republicans are saying, you know, we have to be better stewards of what we have. But Republicans are saying that it's not necessarily us that's causing this problem.
John McCormick, speaking of which, you got Rush Limbaugh saying this week, he said, essentially what this papal encyclical is saying, Rush Limbaugh says, is that every Catholic should vote for the Democratic Party. That's what it is, says Limbaugh. How else do you interpret it when the Pope comes out and sounds like Al Gore on global warming and climate change? What did you make of this big, big statement from the Pope, John?
Well, I would say that Rush Limbaugh is factually incorrect, and I'm guessing that he didn't read all 40,000 words that the Pope wrote, and I'll confess that in the last 24 hours, I have not had the time to read all 40,000 words. I'm guessing not a lot of people have, but from the news coverage and the excerpts that I have read, I think that there's a lot that, you know, traditional American conservatives would like in here. I mean, there's a line in there that says, concern for the protection of the environment is incompatible with the justification for abortion. There's a lot in there that's against population control. You know, curiously, the Pope actually rejects cap and trade, sort of trading carbon credits. It's very much it calls for a more radical change. It's anti-materialist. It's anti-consumption. And I think a lot of conservatives would generally like that. You know, when it comes to Catholics listening to the Pope, what you're required to do as a faithful Catholic is listen to the moral teachings that the Pope is teaching. And the moral teaching here is that we have to have a concern for the environment. You know, the Catholic Church does not teach that the Pope has any special teaching authority into empirical facts as to whether or not global warming is primarily man-made, whether or not we have the ability to reverse the course, even if it is, and whether or not any of these weather events are being caused by global warming, which is much more unlikely.
The Pope seems to think he has some authority here. Are you wiser than the Pope, John, on his authority?
Am I wiser than the, I'm not. No, I agree with the Pope completely in the terms that we need.
He says it's a moral issue. The world's being turned into
issue.
A pile of filth. That he goes pretty far here in citing, you know, specific chemicals and specific courses of action. Even for a conservative Republican, I would think it'd be difficult. He gets into a pretty heavy critique of free market capitalism.
He does. And so I think that you need the moral teaching here is concern for the environment. And that I think that even in the soft sciences, the Pope can make wrong economic judgments. I think that from just what I've read so far, again, without having read all 40,000 words, I think that maybe he doesn't give enough credit for the free market and lifting millions upon or billions upon billions of people out of poverty over the past years. And that actually a lot of the proposals that are being bandied about in terms of counteracting climate change would really hurt the poor the most. I mean, it's these poor countries, India and China, that are burning hydrocarbons faster than you can blink to raise the standard of living of their people. So it's really not just the West consuming too much and more than our fair share. Those are just some thoughts that I have. But yes, yeah. I think that you have to accept the moral teaching, but you can disagree on the empirical analysis and the conclusions on specific policies. And I do think it's interesting that he rejects cap and trade, which is the main policy that a lot of environmentalists support.
Jack, it's interesting. In this long encyclical, and I have read a lot of it, the Pope puts the empirical facts and moral twinned front and center. He doesn't shy from describing the state of the world as he sees it. And of course, he's a trained chemist for whatever that's worth. The man came up through the path of science. You've got a lot of candidates for president so far, Jack, who do not accept what the Pope is saying here, that this is human-caused climate change. Does this encyclical create a problem for those people?
It does, Tom, but if I might, I just want to shift the plane here slightly. Mm-hmm. You know, the Pope says that this global warming is going to hurt the world's poor disproportionately, and he chiefly holds consumer capitalism to blame. But population growth also impacts climate change. Population grew from 1 billion to 6 billion over the 20th century, while emissions of CO2, greenhouse gases, grew 12-fold. Population is expected to surpass 9 billion in the next 50 years with comparable increase in greenhouse gases. You see where I'm going. The church's ban on contraception. You know, returning from a visit to the Philippines, the Pope, this was early in this year, spoke about, quote, the irresponsibility of a mother he had just met who risked her life to bear 7 children. The ban on contraception does not mean you have to have big families, he said, quoting the Pope. Some think, excuse me if I use the word, that in order to be good Catholics, we have to be like, quote, rabbits. That was unfeeling of the Holy Father. Undoubtedly, that woman was trying to be a good Catholic. Was she irresponsible, or was the church that formed her conscience? In the Philippines, as in poor countries all around the world, the church has fought family planning for decades, successfully lobbying politicians to resist the menace of condoms. Climate change undoubtedly is a future threat to the poor. You could argue that the church's ban on birth control is one of the factors driving the poverty of the poor today.
Duly noted. Do you then discount the Pope and his capacity or authority to speak on climate issues because of church teaching on family planning?
Not at all, but I, you know, with many other people, I wish he would address that encyclical from the 1960s that really, I think, set the clock back on the population for the world.
Let's go to Hilton Head, South Carolina, and Celeste. Celeste, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I haven't practiced Catholicism since I was a teenager, and it's been 45 years, but this Pope has definitely gotten my attention. I believe that he's sending out a clarion call for all of us, for every single one of us, to bring some mindfulness and consciousness to what we're doing every day, how we're using the resources that flow through the water pipes into our home, for example. I mean, in the junk that we think we need to have in our lives that poor people are being, you know, enslaved kind of situations to create for us in factories. And it's so huge, and I'm so disappointed in the Republicans for not being responsible to their constituents.
They've stood up on the other side of the ledger, many, against abortion. Does that please you then, Celeste?
No, it doesn't. I feel I have real personal beliefs about that. I don't want to get into, though.
We'll take the climate side of that, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
I listened to a recording of your earlier show about this topic, and I remember that someone said ClimateGate emails proved the scientists were lying.
We had a caller who was in a big-time denialist on all the climate change front. That's true.
Yeah, and the thing is the actual Inspector General of the Department of Commerce, plus a whole bunch of other people, did inquiries into that. They all came back saying the scientists were being honest. And if you read the Bible, it says, thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. And I think that acknowledging the human activity related to global warming is about taking a step closer to the truth and a step away from dishonesty. And I think that the Pope is encouraging people to really face things as they in the truth.
Nate, I appreciate your call from Milwaukee. It will be fascinating to see how this plays out through the presidential campaign with a figure of moral authority, whatever you think about the whole agenda of Catholic teaching, as Pope Francis speaking so forcefully on this. Of course, we had a big movement on that front this week. Jeb Bush, after all those months as an informal candidate, raising lots of money and preparing for a race on Monday in Miami, he finally did formally announce. Here he is talking to the crowd there in English and in Spanish.
As a candidate, I intend to let everyone hear my message, including the many who can express their love of country in a different language. Ayúdenos en tener una campaña que les da la bienvenida. Trabajen con nosotros por los valores que compartimos y para un gran futuro que es nuestro para construir para nosotros y nuestros hijos.
John McCormick, that is the best Spanish I recall any presidential candidate ever speaking. And, of course, if you're not a Spanish speaker, he's talking there, but he says the campaign welcomes you. You know, come and work with us on the values we share, he's saying in Spanish, for a great future to build for ourselves and our children. What about this candidate, Jeb Bush, his prospects, and in particular on the front of reaching out from the GOP to Latino voters, John?
Well, we now have two Republican candidates who are fluent in Spanish, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. I think Jeb gave a very good speech. You know, I would say personally from my perspective, and I think I share this with a lot of other people on the right who are conservative, is that Jeb's problem isn't so much ideological. You know, he was a very conservative governor, a real reformer on education and a number of different issues. His problem is more that people are concerned about his electability, just the Bush name, the fact that he hasn't been in office for 10 years. I think a lot of people just see it if it's another Bush versus another Clinton. It's just sort of this grinding election where it's close, but Bush loses, and you need a kind of a new, fresh face who actually has a chance to shake things up and be the candidate of the future, not the candidate of the past. And that's why I think candidates like Marco Rubio or Scott Walker have a better argument. It's not necessarily that they're more ideologically pure. You know, Jeb Bush's heterodox issues on Common Core immigration, that doesn't really – most of the candidates have, you know, had – positions that aren't completely conservative on immigration. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have supported Common Core in the past. So if there's any problem with Jeb Bush in the Republican primary, it's more temperamental. You know, maybe he's given the impression that he is sort of scolding the conservative base, that he's going to be the adult in the room, sort of this John Huntsman persona where he's going to willing to lose the primary to win the general election. But again, I thought that this speech was very good. It shows that being out there on the campaign trail, taking questions can help you as a candidate. I thought it was a very good contrast with Hillary Clinton, who frankly, in my opinion, I thought she had done a very good job last year during her book tour. She was really more comfortable, more relatable, but seemed to really kind of rusty during that speech. And some more of those robotic tendencies that she's been caricatured for on Saturday Night Live, those seem to be on display in her big speech. And Jeb Bush, very fluid, very conservative, very lively speech. So I think, you know, he's definitely got a good shot to win the nomination, but got a whole lot of time left.
Here was Hillary at her big rally in New York City.
The top-down economic policies that failed us before. Americans have come too far to see our progress ripped away. Now, there may be some new voices in the presidential Republican choir, but They're all singing the same old song. A song called Yesterday.
Hillary Clinton last weekend, April Ryan, Jeb Bush out there with a pretty good speech. Hillary Clinton with her first rally. What do you see emerging, April?
Well, I see Donald Trump emerging, but no. As far as Jeb, he showed me a little bit of a contrast with his against his competitors in the Republican Party. He showed a little bit more inclusion, Latino vote. Also, he brought up Baltimore, and then when he did, and I know a lot of the young people like this, and I thought this was a very good thing that he did, the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show piece, the slow jam, the news. It showed inclusion for young people. I mean, we saw different side of Jeb Bush. When it comes to Hillary Clinton, she's going to have to learn to loosen up a little bit more. She might need to do a slow jam with Jimmy Fallon as well. And I don't know. And maybe figure out how she's going to tiptoe around her husband and bring him in the fold and keep him a distance at the same time.
Hard to see Hillary slow jamming, but who knows in the course of this campaign. Jack Beattie, thoughts on Jeb and Hillary?
How about one thought instead on Donald Trump? To borrow from the late Henry Fairley, Trump's brain is like Australia, a russet fringe of sentience around the edges, a vast emptiness within.
Oh, well, the russet fringe we all know about. The rest I cannot speak to, but as he told us this week, he's rich. He's very, very rich. And we'll see where it goes from there. Great to have all of you with us. John McCormick at the Weekly Standard, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
April, thank you so much for joining us today. And Jack Beattie, thanks to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.